Welcome everyone to another episode of Compressed FM, a podcast all about web development and design with a little bit of zest. In today's episode, we are going to take a deep dive into web forms.
Web development and design, who would have guessed? Well, we can do them both, even add a little zest. So turn up the volume, get ready for the best. Let's get it started in this episode of Compressed.
What's up, everyone? My name is James Hewitt, and I am a full-time technical content creator. I still want a better, more exciting title, but that's all I got for now.
How about Director of Design at Zeal?
Is that? I thought I was now the director of design at Zeal. No, okay.
I was trying to invert my title, like my intro, to be like, I have a better title.
Okay, so you're going to do Director of Design at Zeal. I'm Amy Dutton. And then
I sound like Yoda. Yesterday was
is I.
Is I Amy Dutton. Hello. Nailed it.
Does that cover your intro? I guess it does. Yes,
it does. I said all the pieces and, backwards.
And we have an awesome guest who we are super excited to talk to. I said awesome and then close to the name of Austin. Not that awesome, that Austin. Is really anything. Anyway, welcome to the show. Super excited to have you. We all get to hang out in Texas, I believe. The first time we met in person, and Since you linked to submit and talked about web forms, that's been something you've dove deep into over the course of a while. And anyway, I'm super excited about this. There's like lots more that go into forms, I think, than we kind of appreciate at surface value. So this will be a fun deep dive. But Austin, welcome to the show. Do you want to take a second to introduce yourself and tell people a little bit about your background?
Yes. Hello. My name is Austin Gill. I have a really cute dog named Nugget. I try and bring him on to as many things as I can, but he's not in the room right now. So no special guest appearance. And yeah, I've been building websites for a while. I have a background in, well, I guess I went to school for like kinesiology, but then transitioned into web development out of the love for it because it's awesome. It's been like 10 years, did mostly engineering, but I've been transitioned into developer advocacy over at a company called Akamai that does CDN, web application firewall, edge compute, the full sort of cloud computing services as of last year. And that's been a lot of fun. So what I focus on now is being a developer educator. So creating content that's really trying to help raise developers to, you know, better understanding, being able to build better products and have fun doing so.
Just really quickly, is that something you thought you'd be interested in? Like for me, I kind of fell into DevRel having never thought I would want to be a teacher or do any of the things that I do now from a developer advocate and content creation perspective. But is that something that you knew you're interested in?
Yeah, it kind of landed on my lap as well. I was doing engineering for, like I said, a long time. And in my free time, I was doing a lot of writing and community organization and meetups and speaking and podcasting, things like that. And it just kind of never struck me that that was a job I could get paid for. And so when I realized it, I said, well, let me give it a try. And it's a big trade-off from engineering. Like I really miss writing code every day. And I think that a lot of developer advocates get a lot of attention because that's kind of our job to be out there and be present in the community. But yeah, it's a big trade-off because there's like any given day, you could have a million different tasks to work on and the context shifting is difficult.
Fair enough. But
yeah, agreed. But they're both great. I like writing code and I like talking to people and teaching others. So
yeah, absolutely. Maybe you could take like a minute to give the highest level intro to forms. Because I think probably the more interesting part of the conversation is more the deeper technical details that we don't necessarily think about. And you've mentioned the word like beforehand, like progressive enhancement, I think several times. And then we'll get more into file uploads and how to handle those properly and securely and all these things. But what's kind of the like 1 minute intro to just forms in general at a high level?
Sure. I'll do my best. So I think forms kind of go like coincide. We kind of take them for granted, right? Like almost every website has forms. But back in the day, there was sort of like the web 1.0 where the web was founded on this principle of creating documents and sharing documents is mostly like I put something on a web server and other people can consume it. And then the web sort of 2.0 world arise as websites became more interactive, where it's kind of more of a two-way communication flow. And all of that is dependent on having forms. So you take for granted that probably every single website you go to today is going to have some sort of form. If it's a social media thing, you're posting tweets or likes or whatever. If it's a business, you're submitting contact forms or signing up for newsletters or doing a search or checking out, you know, on something. Or even here where we're just talking to each other, there's a chat window that we can, you know, talk to each other. So it's something that is probably found on every single website. It's necessary in order to send data to let the page know that you want to modify the page or modify something on their end, right? And it's so fascinating to me because it combines so many features like semantic markup, accessibility, how you handle design, some of the challenges there, what you can and can't do, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, how you can enhance it. And like we talked about progressive enhancement and responsible ways of doing that. And yeah, so I've spent a lot of time looking at forms, what forms can do natively, what they sort of can't do, how you can do some sort of hacks to get it to do what we want it to do and like fall back to work for people that, I don't know, are on older browsers or are dealing with other issues. So yeah, that was one deep dive. And then I also, like you said, did another deep dive recently to go into specifically uploading files, which is also covers a lot of fascinating topics.
Yeah. Absolutely.
How's that? Pretty good?
That's great. So like basic form, you define like, where do I want to send this information and what type of request do I want to send? Get, post, put, delete, whatever. Actually, I think you can't do put in a form, right?
Can you can do get and post in just
HTML. And not delete forms. Either. Okay.
Not delete.
See, I'm learning already. So yeah. Basics of like the form, you have inputs. You say, I want to take this data and I want to send it to this location, which is a web address of some sort. And I want to send this data along in this format. What are the things beyond that? So like the potential to bring in JavaScript, what are some of the reasons that people bring in JavaScript to enhance their form or customer user experience for working with forms?
Okay, so probably the three most common places that people bring in JavaScript to enhance forms is custom inputs. So okay. I can't find an input that does what I want across the 24 available options that the platform provides.
24. Wow.
24. So okay. Type,
I know. Yeah.
Can I list them? No.
Can you list them all like, right now?
No, I can. Let me pull up my slides really quick. No, but there's 22 different, like for the input tag, there's 22 different types. And then you also have text area and select.
That makes sense. Okay.
And then, so being able to create something like multi-select, right, where you like type something in or maybe there's like different options to choose from and you see the different options put in as like little pills added to the page or something like that.
Like tags on a YouTube video or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool.
And then the other one is validation. Mm-hmm. So the browser has built-in validation as of HTML5, which is many, many years
old
now.
Pretty old at this point, yeah.
It's okay. It's not great. But that's also kind of okay because you can't rely on client-side validation for your business logic. Like you always need to validate things on the server anyway.
Yeah. And let's just like double click on that cliche like thing. So validation of any input, any validation you do on the front end is user experience. The real like necessary validation has to be on the back end before data gets saved in a database, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like you could inject stuff, right? So it gets entered in on the browser. Somebody like does something malicious to inject it. Mm-hmm. That when it gets sent to the back end, like it could cause problems. If you're
assumes that you're using a browser, right? But if you're building an API that is open or can be accessed outside of specific domains, then I could even use something like a terminal to do a
curl request.
A curl request, yep. Or yeah, Postman exactly. Or something else, right? Yeah. And even if I'm limited to using the browser, I can probably even do a custom fetch request from within my browser console on the domain that's allowed to make requests to that API.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't thought about doing that.
So yeah, so you could even get across. Yeah, I mean, it's weird. This is the other cool thing about working with forms is it just covers such a broad spectrum of security and like white hat hacking thinking. And it's so deep. You know, so the other place that you can consider JavaScript to enhance forms is things like form submissions. So using something like fetch or XML HTTP request to what is it, intercept a form submission and use JavaScript to submit it on the front end or on the in JavaScript. And the benefit there is then you don't do like the default behavior of a full page refresh, which is great and is, again, sort of like you're saying, is a user experience improvement. But so many of these things, so many things of adding JavaScript to enhance a behavior are riddled with potholes and, like, you know, things that you can fall down and make mistakes and break existing features in the browser. So it takes a lot of knowledge, a lot of care, and a lot of testing to sort of do it, quote unquote, right. Mm-hmm. To do it in a way that doesn't, that will work if there's an issue with JavaScript and continue to work, that will work in a consistent way that maintains feature parity with what the browser already offers and doesn't enhance one thing at the cost of breaking something else.
Are there specific pothole, like any ones that come to mind? I imagine a lot of what we've kind of moved to calling out now is bundle size of JavaScript. We're seeing all sorts of frameworks go back to the server as much as possible. We saw the idea of like statically generated content being huge a few years ago. Now we're combining that with also doing a lot of stuff on the server. You see frameworks like Astro are shipping no JavaScript by default. It's multi-page by default, which means it's going to do the full page refresh every time. So is like JavaScript bundle size, is that one of the concerns that people are paying a lot of attention to with whether or not to include JavaScript on the front end for form submissions?
So bundle size almost gets too much credit compared to some of the other issues. If you use JavaScript, so adding JavaScript to a page does ask the user to download more data. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we care about bundle size is because that might make the page load slower. So they have another request to make. They have more data to download. The JavaScript itself, we have to be careful about how performant that is, because once the data is downloaded, then the JavaScript has to actually run. And that could introduce memory leaks or just take a long time to parse something anyway. And that itself is going to use the device resources. So if we're talking about running JavaScript on a phone, that could be slow. That could also cause other operations on the phone to run more slowly. That could also cause the battery to drain faster, depending on, you know, for like a form submission, it's probably not a big deal. Yep. But the thing is, on the flip side, it's not that we shouldn't use JavaScript. It's that we should understand the cost of using JavaScript and the benefit of using JavaScript to do certain actions. Like if I'm on Twitter and I want to like a post, I don't want to take the JavaScript away from that. Because liking a tweet with just HTML, it's possible. You could have a form that when you click it, it's like the submit button and it like reloads the page. And all of a sudden, I've reloaded the page. I've lost the context of where I am. I'm not even looking at the tweet anymore because now I did it from the homepage and now the homepage is refreshed or something like that. That would be a cost benefit analysis where there's pros and cons to both sides, using JavaScript versus not. And I'd say that lies heavier on the side of benefit to using JavaScript, right? Yep. But yeah, it's a lot. And there's so much. I think sort of relevant to the JavaScript question in forms is more around what I see lately, which is there's a lot of modern frameworks that I use and love. Like I like Vue, I like React Enough, I really like Solid. They're all great and I use them. But there's things like people that use state management for inputs, it's like, you probably don't need to do that. What's called like controlled inputs. You probably don't need to do that. In fact, the browser is an excellent state management tool itself, right? Just store the state in the browser. When a user types something into an input, it's stored there. It's saved there. You don't need to store it in memory as well. You don't need to use JavaScript to construct a custom fetch request when a form is submitted for every single form, because then you talk about increasing bundle size and you add 10 forms to 10 different APIs and you're creating a custom fetch request for each of those 10 API requests. You don't need to do that. You could have a single JavaScript function that just intercepts every single form request, reads what the form should already have there in the HTML, where the form dictates what the method is that it should send it, what the action is, or like what the API route is using the action, grabs the data off of the inputs on that form and sends them. And you can write the same single JavaScript function for every single form on your website if you wanted to.
This is something I've never thought about before. That seems like it would get like trickier the more detailed you go down into it. Because if you're like intercepting the regular form submission, all of the regular form submissions, translating that to like you doing your own fetch request and you've got the data and you inspect the form to find out where to send it. One thing that comes to mind is like feedback. Like if that fails, are you going to have to do like a bunch of conditional logic in that function to be able to handle like specific like error codes maybe?
So yes and no, right? I mean, this is where it gets into like the subjective sort of it depends thing on your application. Let's say you have, if you're dealing with error codes, you may have a flow that when a form is submitted, it's going to send like a little pop-up notification or like a toast notification that lets the user know, hey, we got your form, or, oh, there was an error, right? Like that's pretty generic. And you could have a single function that anytime the HTTP response comes back with an error status code, you can have a single function that handles every single form. And if you want to do something that's more specific to an individual form, then I would say it's probably better to have a single function that handles every form and then have exceptions instead of just assuming every single form needs to be, you know, a custom fetch request.
Yeah.
Another spicy take is like, you probably don't need JSON. Like you probably don't need, JSON is probably the wrong format to send HTTP request, post requests with.
Ooh, tell me more.
Yeah. So, well,
do you have examples of these? Because that would be great in the show notes if we could include.
I have a couple blog posts that I can that we can link to, and maybe I'll. Yeah, I'm not going to post them now, but
yeah, you're fine.
Follow up after. This will be the treat for the people that come back, you know, in the post production, the podcast stuff.
Make it work.
Real listeners.
Yeah, since y'all are missing out on, you know, the facial expressions and the eye contact. So the whole idea here, the whole like JavaScript versus not question really stems from a larger discussion around progressive enhancement or the topic of progressive enhancement. And if you've never heard of progressive enhancement, it's basically this idea that you should build your applications in such a way that you start with a minimum viable product or like a minimum working condition for as many users as possible, or at least as many users as you want to target. So, you know, take stock of which devices, which browsers you want to support, and then make sure that what you do works across all of those. And more often than not, if you start with HTML as your base, that's going to work across the most environments. And where progressive enhancement and JavaScript, where the discussion overlaps, is around the availability of JavaScript or not. So progressive enhancement says, you know, write your applications in a way that they work across the most environments. Well, what happens if JavaScript is not available, right? Then if you rely on JavaScript, you're not progressively enhancing. You're basically, if you rely on JavaScript, it's going to break if JavaScript is not available. So the progressive enhancement approach of doing this is, if you need to make an HTTP request, the browser and HTML have two forms that support that built in. One is the form tag, one is the link tag. And you can do get and post requests. You can do get requests with a link tag, and you can do get and post requests with a form tag. Right?
I've never thought about links in the context of forms. But it, like, I get the parallel, like why you group those together, because it does have the ability to send you to the server. It's just a GET request specifically versus a GET or POST with a form.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say links are, like, I wouldn't group them with forms necessarily, but if the question is, how can the browser make an HTTP request, those are the two options.
Yeah.
Or how can HTML make an HTTP request, not the browser. So then the idea is, okay, well, we start with building out all of the functionality that we need to, let's say, make our API request with forms. So you say, let me start with a form tag. Let me define the HTTP method using the method attribute. Let me define the HTTP endpoint using the action attribute. And then I can put in all of my inputs, make sure they're accessible, have labels, have all the things, you know, and use the existing tools. And also, probably 99% of the form interactions that people make custom inputs for have some sort of analogous option with just HTML. So if you need to send a text input, you can use a text input. If you need to select a date, you can use the date input. If you need to select from a list of options, if you can only select one, there's radios or the select input. If you need to select multiple, there's checkboxes or the select input with multiple attribute on, right? So almost every single form that you need can be done with HTML. And there are exceptions to the rules. We should talk about those as well. But so you build out your form, you're using all of the native things. It works with HTML. You make sure that you test it. It works, you know, it's responsive. It works across devices that are 10 years old. It's going to work as far into the future as you can probably imagine. And that's great. And then so the progressive enhancement topic says, well, now we've covered our bases for an environment that has no JavaScript and it's still going to work. And now if we add JavaScript to this form, we know that it's going to work whether it's available or not. So now let's add JavaScript to sort of play on top of this. And the tricky or the requirement here is that the behavior is the same with or without JavaScript. So you don't do something fancy for people that have JavaScript. I mean, you can make it fancy as long as it behaves the same. So getting back to the question around JSON is that the browser or HTML has no way of sending JSON. So at the point that you decide that you're going to submit HTTP requests with a JSON body, you have already stepped off the path of progressive enhancement, which is fine.
Yeah.
Again, like sometimes for some interactions that makes sense or is a requirement, but
that's a great,
you know, you have to weigh costs and benefits. And there's a lot of people that, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask. So we keep saying if they don't have JavaScript. What is the percentage of people that actually don't have JavaScript? Like, what are we talking about?
So that was going to get to my next point, which when you, it's funny because progressive enhancement is not against JavaScript. It's just that there's so much overlap in those. It's such a good example of the conversation that people on both sides just assume we're talking about JavaScript, right? It's the same for like when CSS pushes out new features, you can do detection on whether that feature is available in the browser. And you want to do that, right? For the browsers that had support for grid, we could make like a nicer layout. And for the people that didn't, you could do like maybe a float-based layout or even just like a vertical layout instead of like a grid layout. And that is the idea that, you know, it works for both parties. Mm-hmm. So around JavaScript, like progressive enhancement in JavaScript is a discussion because, yeah, of course you say, well, we should build this to work without JavaScript. And then the first question is like, well,
how often does that happen?
Yeah, how often does it happen? Or are we building for people that turn JavaScript off in the browser? And if they turn it off, then they're kind of responsible for a broken experience. And that may be true. This also kind of depends, like there's ways for you to gather usage metrics on your application on whether JavaScript is available or not. And that's like the right answer is measure your audience and then see how many people it's working for or not. Then you can make an informed decision. That said, it's not whether people have JavaScript disabled in their browser. It's whether JavaScript experiences some sort of error in loading or error in loading or running, right? Let me see. I actually have, there's another awesome website on like reasons why JavaScript fails. I'm going to post it in our chat here, but it basically runs down a bunch of questions that are like, if the page hasn't loaded yet, JavaScript is not running, obviously. So if the HTML has downloaded, but it hasn't gone to the JavaScript script, JavaScript is not available. And I don't know how many times you've run into a scenario where you see a button on a page and you try and click the button and it does nothing. And that might be because it's a slow connection and JavaScript either hasn't downloaded or the browser hasn't finished parsing it or things like that, right? But it could be the page hasn't loaded, the connection dropped, the connection timed out, there's a corporate firewall that blocked that connection, the ISP could have interfered with that JavaScript loading, the client could be using a micro browser, which is really popular these days, they could have JavaScript turned off, they could have their data saver mode turned on, there could be an extension installed in the browser that blocks or interferes with that JavaScript. There could be an ad blocker running. That JavaScript could be running from a CDN that could be experiencing some downtime. The browser that they are using may not run the feature of JavaScript that you wrote. A library that you could be using could have introduced a bug. The library that you're using could have introduced a change that, like the API could have changed, or you could have written a bug. And at any of those points, it's interesting because if JavaScript throws an error, it's very unforgiving. It's not like the rest of the JavaScript is not going to execute, right? And the whole like topic of progressive enhancement is also really important because you have to account for what is the most important thing for users to do on your site, or let's say back in the context of forums, what is the most important thing for a user to do when this form is filled out? If it's a pay button, I really want that to work across as many environments as possible.
If it's a send bad feedback button, you know, not so important.
Don't even hook it up.
For some reason, this form doesn't work.
I'll
get on it as soon as I can.
No, you just send a pop that says, thanks, we've received your feedback and we really appreciate it.
And you look in the network tab and there's no network for us at all. It's like, man,
they must be using some sort of different protocol.
Really quickly, there was a question in the chat for someone who missed a few minutes. What were the potholes with intercepting form operations with JavaScript? And it's kind of what you just mentioned, which is the idea of progressive enhancement, which means you support core browser functionality with forms first, and then you support additional JavaScript features through JavaScript if and when JavaScript is available. And then you were kind of listing out the reasons that either JavaScript may not be available, or it hasn't been parsed yet, or it may have a library had a bug and like caused the JavaScript to like stop running or something like that. But in case JavaScript isn't available for whatever reason, you're building for the core browser form submission process first. And the key thing to recap for myself that was interesting was I've always done posting my data as JSON. So when I do an e.prevent default, take that data, post it to my API endpoint, I post it as JSON. The reason that's a problem is it's not matching parity from the browser, because the browser sends like multi-form data, or the, what's the technical term, like multi-part? No, we're not there yet. Sorry. What's the actual term? Because you can do it with the query params or in a Git or as form data in a post. Those are the two things, right? Query params or just form data.
There's technically three content types that HTML can set, but generally the default is like www URL search params or something
search
like that.
Search params.
And then the other one is multi-part form data.
Okay.
And then the third one is, I don't remember, but no one ever uses it.
Something. Fair. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
But yeah. Okay. So to sort of answer this question, like the whole JSON thing is just one piece of the puzzle. So let's break down like what could possibly go wrong if I want to use JavaScript to just enhance a form submission. There's a lot. First of all, I'm literally writing a presentation about this. So things that you can do to accidentally break existing browser features, which you don't want to do, is like you can accidentally break the actual functionality of the form. You can fuss around with the accessibility. You can break keyboard navigation. You can break how error messages are communicated to assistive technology. The browser inherently has nice features. Like on an invalid submit, it will scroll to the invalid input and highlight it. So that does a lot for assistive technologies as well as user experience. It's like, I can see where I messed up. Whereas if you do that with JavaScript, you may not actually scroll. And if it's a very long form where the invalid input is off screen,
you have no idea where to go.
You broke that, right? Like that's a nice feature that you broke.
That's true. Because I've definitely been in the situation where you have a long form, you go all the way down to submit, it says data is no good, and it doesn't tell you where, and it doesn't take you to where, and then you have to go and scroll, and maybe they have like the red outline that shows you which input is not.
It's a giant pain in the butt. And these are things that you take for granted, especially as developers, and you're like, look at this awesome thing I did. I made it so the page doesn't have to refresh. And that is awesome. That is a better experience. It's not at the cost of. It's just as long as you account for all of the things that we've talked about with JavaScript, increasing bundle size, potentially affecting performance, potentially affecting battery life, potentially affecting other processes on the device, and all of these other nice things that the browser does for you by default. Cool. Yep. You cover those? Yeah, hell yeah. Like, use JavaScript and enhance those forms, baby. Do it. Love it. But some of these other things that like we can do is, let's say like auto save, right? If you go to a configuration page in your settings on some application and you like click a checkbox, I want that HTTP request to go by default. I don't want to have to hit a submit button. That's a nice feature. Or keyboard shortcuts. I'm like typing a message and I hit control enter and that like sends the message. These are all nice features that we can add, but you want to make sure browsers have built-in features like you literally cannot spam a submit button on just an HTML form. Like you hit it and the page reloads. That has a built-in spam protection feature. You intercept that request and prevent that default behavior with JavaScript, someone can, yeah, like smash that button a ton of times and
smash that subscribe button.
Exactly. The content type headers that you talked about, multi-part form data versus URL search params, right? You want to make sure that those maintain parity because that's important for how the backend receives it, right? Like if you prevent the default behavior and you don't set the headers or you don't know what the headers are doing, you may be breaking how you communicate with the API. Respecting server redirects. So when the browser or when the server receives a request, it might send a response that says, cool, we got it. We did the work. Now redirect to this page. You intercept that with JavaScript. You have to make sure, well, you should make sure that you're reading the headers on the response object and saying, oh, is this like, is it telling me a different location to go to? I should probably do that. Server errors, existing keyboard shortcuts. I hate when people prevent copy and paste or like make some fancy keyboard shortcuts for their application, but it overwrites something that's native to the browser, like Control S, Control P, I don't know, some of the ones that are built in. So those are some of them. Now, this is all like large scale. If we get into just the form submission, one of the first issues that you see is tutorials tell you if you want to enhance the form submission, the first thing you do is capture the submit event and then run event.prevent default. That is a big red flag because that means that if any of the, even if you want to do progressive enhancement where your form is built to fall back to HTML, if JavaScript is available, you prevent the default behavior, that's out the window. And now if you're, if the rest of that script or that handler experiences an error and doesn't get to make the actual fetch request, that request is never going to be sent.
So are you saying you wouldn't call prevent default first? You would make sure you've done your thing before
you do the work. And then if the body of that handler experiences an error and it doesn't get a chance to prevent the default behavior, then it's going to throw the error. It's going to stop executing. It's never going to prevent the default behavior. It's going to fall back to the default browser behavior, which is a native form submission that refreshes the page.
Mm-hmm. I've never once not put e.prevent default first.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, I've got a bunch of blog posts that I can share to talk about this stuff.
I'm also curious how, like, SvelteKit handles things, because you can write your form so that it all gets handled on the server, and then they have a use enhance attribute that you can put on the form that will handle everything. So I'm curious if that does the magic for you.
The short answer is yes. Like, Svelte, Remix, they do a really good job of respecting or building with progressive enhancement in mind. Mm-hmm. And these modern tools are really awesome. But as someone that, like, you know, I know it sounds like I'm just railing against JavaScript, and I'm not. Like, I love it. It's my programming language of choice. I love writing JavaScript. But, you know, as long as you do it responsibly. And it takes, I also don't expect a lot of beginners or people that are new to this or people that have been doing it for years. I don't expect these people to know all of these things, because as much as the word that I use frequently is like fundamentals, I think it takes decades to understand all of the fundamentals, to know everything the browser is doing and the responsible approach to working with it. And that's where, you know, I'm trying to create content that educates people. And I think that it's great that there's tools that you can grab off the shelf that kind of do the work for you, like Svelte's enhanced features. I still think it's important to understand the underlying principles, because you're probably not going to be using Svelte in 10 years. I mean, nothing against it. It's excellent tooling, great, great library, amazing authors. But that's just sort of the state of the industry.
Yeah, I was going to say, even if you are using SvelteKit, it's not going to look like it does now. And same for React or Vue or any of the other things. They're totally going to look different in 10 years than they do now.
Yeah. And some people go into this argument of, oh, well, that's why you should learn the fundamentals first, or, oh, you should learn the framework first, or, oh, it sounds the same as, oh, you should go to school, or, oh, you should go to boot camps. And like, no, the fact is that this stuff is all, is it's just going to take a long time, no matter what. Mm-hmm. Learning a framework first is a fine approach, as long as you're backfilling, understanding the underlying principles, or you can start with learning the underlying principles, and then you can start with a framework. And they both have pros and cons, and people learn differently, and it's fine, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that kind of takes us to the end of my tirade on on forms. And yeah, I have several blog posts that I'm happy to share in the show notes that go into more depth on how to write forms that are semantic and then accessible, and then how you can use modern CSS to do things that used to rely on JavaScript, and we can use modern CSS to do one of the major pain points. I mean, there's a lot of pain points with doing things with HTML, but there's a lot of benefit, right? So that's why progressive enhancement is good, because we get all of the benefits. But as we can sort of start with HTML, get all the benefits of that, and then introduce CSS and get all the benefits of that, and then we can introduce JavaScript and get all the benefits of that, and doing it in a way that is responsible and intentional and deliberate, then we can sort of capture all of the powers of each and build forms with superpowers, which is literally the talk that I'm working on right now.
Do you have that talk scheduled, by the way, like for an event?
Yeah, although it's an online event that is happening at like 3 a.m. So I'm just going to be recording it and sharing it. But I will have a link that I can share. And yeah, it's sort of built on a lot of the content that I'll be sharing here anyway.
Cool. What's the name of the event? Are you allowed to share that?
I actually don't remember off the top of my head. There's a few that I've got coming up, and I don't remember exactly which one this is for.
Yeah, fair enough. I think you were kind of transitioning to this, but do you want to move into like the, what am I saying? Uploads, file uploads?
Yes.
Portion of forms?
So yeah, so this gets more interesting, and it is kind of a natural progression. We talk about forms, progressive enhancement, and then the latest deep dive that I've gone into is about file uploads, which itself is another one of those topics that we take for granted for being sort of seems easy on the surface, but is surprisingly difficult. Even the most basic file upload is like, you know, thinking back to when I got started, I was like, okay, I want to upload a file to a server. Great. I've got a form. All I need is a file input. So you do input type of file and you hit submit. And if you sort of receive that on the back end and maybe you even like log the data, you just get like, I think by default, you just get the name of the file as a string.
And not even the actual bytes of the file, like not even the data?
No. No.
Okay.
So that's kind of the first stumbling block. It's like, well, how do I send a file then? And the answer is you have to set the correct content type. And this kind of goes back to the JavaScript thing is like there's a whole bunch of other potholes around intercepting forms and making sure that you're capturing the data correctly and making sure that you're setting the right content type and putting the data either in the query string parameters or in the body if it's one or the other in a GET or a POST request or whatever. Maybe I'll even like include, I'm sure I have some JavaScript somewhere that kind of shows how to do that. But yeah, if you want to send a form with or a file with an HTML form, you have to set the content type to, or sorry, the enc type attribute. You have to assign the enc type attribute on the form to multipart form data, which then tells the browser to send the HTTP request with a content type header of multipart form data. And that's how the browser has access to send that data as binary.
Okay.
And then you say, okay, well, I've got it sending with HTML. We want to do the progressive enhanced thing. So we want to send it with JavaScript as well. You have to do the same thing. There's some really funny things that the browser does when you send things with JavaScript in the body of a POST request. Well, actually, let me go back because this is kind of interesting. There's actually three things you need to do in order to send a file. You need to send a POST request because you have to send the file as the body. You can't send it in the URL. You have to set the content type to multipart form data, and you have to have access to the file itself, which the browser or HTML by default doesn't have access to the file system. And so you need a file input in order to have access to the file on the device, right? With JavaScript, you have to do those same things, but you can do them in a different way. You can intercept a form, you can capture the data using a form data constructor, and just by putting the form data constructor in the body of the request, that automatically sets the HTTP headers to content type multipart form data. So that's a little tidbit that you should know if you're ever going to use form data API. And then using URL search params API automatically sets the content type headers to URL search params. It's kind of like a weird little quirk thing, but it's, again, one of those things that's like, if you don't know that it's doing that, it could totally change how the request is received on the back end.
Right. And I've definitely been in that position many times as a developer, and I still don't feel like I pay the detailed, pay enough attention to detail with that sort of thing, of having no idea the impact of those headers and where it affects what and how and why, especially when getting into a new serverless environment, for example, like they all kind of do things a little bit differently and maybe have expected defaults that are different And that's anyway, so it's really interesting to kind of like drill down into those more specifically, because it's the kind of thing that I haven't paid enough attention to in the past.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of thing that you don't need to pay attention to until you sort of cross the chasm from front end to back end and start receiving that data. And a lot of the time, APIs that you send things to, whether it's going to be JSON or URL search params or form data, a lot of APIs are like, we'll just accept all of those different content types and do some logic to massage it into eventually the data that we'll need.
Yeah.
And maybe in like Express is a good example, one of the most popular Node.js backend frameworks. It doesn't handle these things by default. So you have to have the body parser, and then you have to have the like JSON parser or something like that. And you have to have a different one for multi-part form data. So it's interesting. And yeah, that goes into a whole deep dive on like, how does Node.js receive these? Well, Node receive, like backend, HTTP itself is beautiful because when you send a file, you don't want to send the entire thing as one massive payload, right? Let's say you have a 10 gigabyte file or a 5 gigabyte file. You can't send that as one request payload. You have to open up the request and then the browser will stream it one little chunk at a time. It can't send 5 gigabytes, but it can send like little amounts as chunks. These are called chunks, which are part of streams, which if it's the first time you're hearing these, really, really cool to learn, really hard to learn, or at least it was for me. Really weird concepts. But it's really important to understand, especially if you're building backends, to understand how the browser receives a request and receives those chunks or those packets of data as chunks, as streams. Because it becomes a factor when you receive that data, what you do with that data. Now, a lot of requests are going to receive data, like let's say like a JSON request or just whatever, it'll receive that data and store it in memory. And then you have like a request handler that might do something with that data in memory and like write it to the database or, you know, validate it or whatever. It's a lot more difficult to do that when you're talking about files, because if you're dealing with a 5 gigabyte file and you're storing all of that request in memory and you have 4 gigabytes of RAM on your server, you're
screwed.
Yeah, it's going to fall over and you're done, right? So this also gets into like weird concepts like buffers, which, you know, is like when you go to the gym and you work out for a while,
you get buffer. That's what I've been doing recently.
Yeah. It's great. No, but it's like these really weird, heady subjects that I don't like to throw out lightly, because especially like mouth blogging, it's like it's just hard to explain. And it's okay if you don't understand it, but things that are kind of like, if you let it wash over you enough times and you think, oh, that's like a keyword to go and like learn later on and maybe come back to it 3 or 4 times, eventually you get it and that's good. But anyway, these like buffers or like chunks of data, the sort of better approach is to take that stream of data as it comes in and do something with it to release it from memory. So there's a couple of options. You can take that stream, that chunk of data, and write it to, now we're getting into streams, which are also weird, and like pipes, and like send it somewhere. But you can say, you can tell Node, hey Node, I want you to open up a file at this location. And when a chunk of data comes in, I want you to write it to that file. And when the next one comes in, write it, you know, append it to that file. But release that memory when you're done writing it to the file. And that way you can take 5 gigabytes of data on a 1 gigabyte of RAM machine and handle that request just fine. And by the end of the request, it's written everything to the file system. And, you know, maybe instead of storing the file contents in memory, it passes like details about the file. So an object that says where it's written, what size it is, what the content type is, or the extension, the name, things like that. So then your request handler has information about the file without having the file contents, because it doesn't need that. Cool?
Yeah. And one of the things I mentioned beforehand was, and we don't necessarily have to address this now, but one of the things that becomes more difficult with serverless functions is not having access to file system to be able to store that data as an intermediary, basically, as you then go to upload it to a database or something. So that's one of the challenges I've come across in the past.
Yeah, so serverless, I mean, you may have access to the file system. The problem is you don't necessarily have access to that same operating system the next time the function runs. So they're like serverless runs in an environment, like an ephemeral system, right? So if you're writing Node in a serverless environment, Node has access to the file system and can write to it. But the way serverless works is like functions come up and down on different machines. And like, there's no guarantee that the file that you wrote to or the file you wrote is going to be there the next time that function runs. Or the file will be there. It's just on a different machine than where the function is running. Mm-hmm. So the sort of solution here is to have a shared sort of central place to store files off of the machine that's running the serverless function. Generally speaking, this is going to be like an object storage solution. So Akamai has object storage solutions, and some of the benefits to this is, one, they work great for serverless environments because all of the serverless functions that are receiving file uploads can just write to the same storage location. And then maybe instead of tracking where the file is on disk, you track where the file is in your object storage provider. And two, it's actually going to be a much more cost-effective way to store files. I know Akamai's pricing is like, if you were to go from the smallest compute service, I think that's like $5 a month, and you have 25 gigabytes of storage, and let's say you're like writing everything to that disk, and then you run out of disk space, and you're like, oh, well, we need to upgrade the server. There's plenty of reasons to upgrade the server, more compute, more CPU, whatever. But if all you need is to add more disk space, you can, I think it's like $5 more or $7 more a month, and you get an additional 25 gigabytes of storage. But for object storage, you could take that $5 a month and put it to object storage. You're going to get 250 gigabytes. Yeah. So it's like, it's huge, right? And that's in addition to also working in serverless and being designed for file storage and high availability and things like that. Now, the tricky thing is, when I get these files in my serverless function, how do I actually write them to object storage, right? Mm-hmm. And there's sort of two approaches. One that's more common uses signed URLs. This is like most tutorials are going to use signed URLs, which is basically your serverless function is going to say, talk to the object storage provider, say, hey, can you give me a URL? I want to put a file in this specific location. And it's going to respond with this URL that's signed and generally has some sort of short-term expiration date. So you respond with that URL to the client, and then the user can upload directly to the object storage. So it's kind of like a daisy chain of user to serverless, serverless to object storage. Object storage brings the signed URL back to the server. That passes the signed URL back to the user. And then the user goes directly to object storage. That's the more common approach. That's not the approach that I love because I care about progressive enhancement. And it's really hard to do that flow. And I don't think you even can use that flow because I think you have to use a put request, which HTML doesn't support. Therefore, you cannot progressively enhance. So I actually wrote a blog post about how you can stream the upload from the client to your serverless environment and use what's called a pass-through stream, which basically, instead of writing to disk, you just take those chunks of data as they come and you write them to another request that does a put request to the object storage provider by default. Okay. This sounds great. It has actually some pretty major drawbacks as well, in that when you're just passing a signed URL back and forth, your server is dealing with very little ingress and egress. And that's like the data that's transferred, right? Because the user on the signed URL approach, the user's not transferring the file to your server, and the server is not transferring the file to the object storage provider. So you're just paying for like very little text going through like, hey, I need a signed URL, and here it is. When you do a stream, user is uploading that file to your server, which is the ingress, which you might pay for data transfer into your server. And then you're also passing all of that data out to a different service. So you might be paying for the egress as well. So this can be a factor depending on what your application does and the architecture and this and that. And then, any questions? Should I continue on to sort of the next thing, which is like, well, the other flaw of object storage, which is...
I think I'm good, Amy.
Yeah?
Okay. So one of the major flaws of object storage then is that, generally speaking, you deploy it to a single region in the world. And you'd probably want that to be as close to your users as possible, because then if your application, let's say you upload the file, you know where it's going to live in object storage, you store that information in the database, and then if it's like a profile photo or whatever, you load your application, you want to load that profile photo from the object storage URL, then you want that file, you want that object storage location to be as close to where your users are as possible, so that when they have to download that, you know, profile picture, it takes a shorter amount of time. It's a performance thing. But the problem is, as your application grows, or as you become more famous, people start coming from all over the world, right? So you have people coming from Tokyo and Toronto and Toledo, and you don't know where to put that object storage. So the solution here is to use something like a CDN, where, should I go into explaining what a CDN is? This could be a whole topic as well. a CDN is
just the high level.
Yeah. So it stands for Content Delivery Network. And it's basically, it basically can sit in the middle of a user's request and your origin server. So in this case, an origin server would be that object storage location. So if a user from Tokyo makes a request, instead of going directly to the object storage URL where the file exists, they'll go, you'll deploy a CDN and change your DNS in a way that the requests are routed to the CDN first. And a CDN has, in Akamai's case, again, I'm not trying to be a salesperson, but these are overlapping services that we offer. So yeah. I'll just speak to like what we do. Akamai has, I think, 300,000 servers around the world. So everywhere all over the world, you're going to be as close to you. Like, they have servers as close to the user as possible. So when the user in Tokyo,
I've got one in my living room. It's crazy.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah, you don't even know it, right? you're listening to it. No, I'm just kidding. So a user in Tokyo wants to make a request to that image. You set up your architecture in such a way that the request goes through the CDN. And that CDN is probably going to also be in Tokyo. And it goes through the CDN, and then maybe the CDN has an opportunity to check whether they have a version of that image in cache. And if it does, it can respond right away. So within, let's say in that example, within, you know, 5 miles is where the user is. That's the distance the request has to travel. If the CDN doesn't have a version in cache, then it'll go through the CDN and says, oh, I don't have it. Let me go to the object storage location. You actually get the original version of the image that comes back. So that request isn't any faster for the first user. But for every other user in Tokyo, they're just going to go to that CDN location, and it's going to be, I mean, like milliseconds. I mean, and, you know, single double digit milliseconds probably. Mm-hmm. Whereas I've done some testing, and a single image can be, or like a round trip, maybe around the world, sort of realistic, sort of worst case scenario might be like 300 milliseconds. Yep. And you say, okay, well, 300 milliseconds is not that big of a deal for a profile picture. Like, that's a fraction of a second, right? This becomes a bigger issue with other static assets that are like CSS, JavaScript, HTML, because these are all, what are they called? Blocking resources, blocking assets. What is it? What is the term?
From
render blocking resources.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So render blocking resources are important to pay attention to because of how the browser loads a page, parses the HTML top to bottom. And when it comes across a render blocking resource like CSS, it's going to say, okay, I need to stop execution, or I need to stop parsing. I need to go and download this CSS. I need to parse that, and then I can continue rendering, right? And this is important because the browser needs to know where that CSS lives and what the CSS does before it can actually render the page and lay things out. This is called the critical render path. It also needs to do the same for JavaScript. So if you add those 300 milliseconds for the 10 assets you have on your page that are render blocking, and 10 may be a large number, but let's just, you know, whatever, you've added 3 seconds
adding up, yeah,
just in loading, right? And that's all dead time. That's all time that the request is just in flight. That's not the time spent parsing. It's not the time spent executing, right? Yep. It's just
bleh, just retrieving the data. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a waste of time. Yep. So anyway, CDNs are awesome. And yeah, like I said, that there's like, Akamai has it. I would encourage you. I think it's the most expansive network, but it's also generally used by more like enterprise level customers. So we generally can't share who our customers are because of like privacy reasons.
Yeah.
But I usually just say, think of the first company that comes to mind and I can't confirm or deny, but most likely it's like a customer that is an Akamai customer, right? And in addition to that, there's like, so how much time do we have, by the way? Do we need to like,
because we should probably wrap in the next couple of minutes, which is a good, like, this is always a great problem to have, but yeah, probably a couple more minutes.
That's cool. Well, yeah, let me finish with like this last little pitch. CDNs are also cool because I think that kind of tackles almost all of the uploads concerns, right? So now we have uploads on how we do it on the front end, how we do it in JavaScript and enhance it progressively, how we deliver it to our backend, how we handle serverless environments and reduce costs by using object storage, how we improve delivery and performance of those files. And then there's sort of the last missing piece, which is security. And CDNs are really awesome because when you integrate a CDN at their sort of edge and a user makes a request, CDNs can do more than just look for static files and like improve the performance there. And this, I'm not even trying to just pitch like something that my company does. There's tons of CDNs out there and they've all kind of advanced to this point where they provide these services of performance improvement. But also once you have users going through a CDN, they can do certain things that your server probably can't on its own. And that is doing some sort of network diagnostic and seeing how these requests are, how the network is sort of behaving and starting to identify troublesome patterns and see where potential attackers are coming from and start to protect your server. So this is really interesting because now you have maybe some requests that are being blocked at the CDN off of your server. And that means all of the good requests have more resources that can, like your server is freed up from handling the bad requests to do more processing of the good requests. It's going to run faster. Maybe it can run cheaper. You can handle the same sort of traffic that you could have before, but at a lower price, a lower cost. And specifically as it relates to file uploads, you can, the last sort of topic to discuss is around malware, right? If you have people that are trying to upload malware, how do you protect against that? OWASP.org is a great organization. They have an awesome cheat sheet specifically for malware protection. And I'll have a blog post that kind of follows along this, where we basically implement file uploads in Node using Formidable. Great library, highly recommend it. And walk through some of the OWASP recommendations on preventing bad files using checking file extensions, checking content types, checking, preventing files that are too large from being stored on your service, which could cost you money and bandwidth again, and then doing malware protection. Malware protection is especially hard because it adds a lot of overhead if you were to, say, receive a file, scan it for malware, and then respond. Because one, in order to scan it, the file has to be written on disk. So it's already on your, like you already have this malware on your service, on your server, before you can even scan it. Ideally, you want to prevent that, right? Number two, scans can take a long time and it can take too long for a request response cycle to do a scan.
Yeah.
So then the solution is like, well, okay, let's take the file, write it disk, respond, tell the user, okay, we got it. But then you want to kick off some sort of background task that's going to do the scan. And so the solution to this is like, take the file, grab the metadata of the file, store that information like the file name, the file size, the content type, where it is on disk, and then a flag to say whether it's been scanned or not. And then you have some background job that scans it. For bad files, maybe it deletes it off the system and deletes the entry from the database. For good files, it updates the entry in the database that says, hey, this file is clean and scanned. And then to protect users, you can either limit the list of files that are available to users on the front end to those that have been scanned, or if you're like listing a, or if you're like a Dropbox or something that shows a list of files, you can show the metadata of a file that has not been scanned, but don't allow users to download it. So that's a solution. And yeah, once again, I do want to like just kind of pitch one of the products that Akamai has, which is malware scanning, which it can do at the edge. So this is really especially powerful because now you don't have to worry about doing the scan on your service. It can block those at the edge, which means you can avoid some of this whole rigmarole and the malware never actually gets onto your server. Now, it has its own limitations, I think, with the size of file uploads, but it's cool. I've used it and it's really awesome.
Cool. It's really nice when you get into one of those more encompassing infrastructure hosting, like whatever the highest general word is, company products, where they have all these different tools that work well together. Like, that's always one of the benefits of getting into and investing in one bigger platform that can help you in different phases of application development, security, like performance, all those things. It's cool to see all those things tied together.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, you know, I don't want this to come, like, I really don't like when people use Stage or platforms as an opportunity to pitch their product or service or whatever. I hope that this, like, there's a lot of really awesome companies out there that offer similar things. And I think that there's the right, it's horses for courses, right? There's the right tool or the tool that's going to be better for some people and better for others. So yeah, my main goal is to educate people. And hopefully if Akamai is a good fit, then, you know, come talk to me. Or if you have more questions just about like learning, come talk to me. But my main goal is, yeah, help people build better websites. Yeah.
Absolutely. That's always been my take for developer advocacy, is providing value first and then have that value be subtly associated with the company that you work for, because you do represent a company. But most importantly, if people trust the education that you're able to provide and learn from you, they're then going to want to pay attention to the company and product that you work for. I feel like this was like a really natural progression too, of like super high level forms, more details about forms and progressive enhancement and like deeper technical aspects of that I hadn't considered, getting into files and then getting into the next level of that. I was like at an enterprise, like even before enterprise level, but at a serious application level, like here's additional things that you got to be thinking about, because people want to mess up your system because it's fun and you have to be prepared to handle that.
Yeah. Yeah. So we squeezed like 3 full talks into
yeah.
conversation. So there's a whole lot, like definitely consider this the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole lot, and there's a lot of even better content than I produce, but I'll link to the things that I have just because they're convenient and available. But I'll probably throw like 10 links into the show notes here.
Perfect.
And I'll try and share those as well for the folks on the live stream.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Cool. All right. I think that is going to wrap up this episode. Austin, thank you for joining us. This was a ton of fun. Hopefully we'll get to see you more in-person stuff in the future. And we made this joke earlier, but I'll repeat it again. If people enjoyed the podcast, make sure to leave a rating and review to help other people find the podcast so we can continue to bring on more amazing guests. In the meantime, that's all we got.